I question whether the United States is ready to assume all the responsibilities.
Korean tensions grow as the United States sends a carrier strike group to the region. It's Tuesday, April 11th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to check us out online on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a former U.S. diplomat discusses a pathway to resolution with North Korea. In Cambodia, what does it mean for the Seabees to leave? Plus, some of the challenges of being an Asian-American entrepreneur. It all starts right now on VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us, and along with me, my colleague, is Steve Miller. President Donald Trump is raising concerns that he's prepared to put America's interests ahead of those regional allies as a U.S. Navy strike force heads towards waters near North Korea. The threat of force against North Korea has gained new credibility following U.S. airstrikes against Syria for using chemical weapons on its own people. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the military strike against Syria was a warning to other countries, including North Korea, that, quote, a response is likely if they pose a danger. The U.S. Pacific Command says it ordered the USS Carl Vinson Group, a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier and accompanying ships, including guided missile destroyers and aircraft squadrons, to sail toward the Korean Peninsula as a prudent measure, citing Pyongyang's reckless, irresponsible, and destabilizing nuclear and ballistic missile provocations. The Trump administration has placed a high priority on preventing North Korea from developing a credible long-range nuclear ballistic missile capability that could threaten U.S. national security. But political analyst Bong Yung-shik of the Yonsei University Institute for North Korean Studies says launching an attack against the North is a risky proposition that is likely to cause more harm than good.
I question whether the United States is ready to assume all the responsibilities for the consequences of that action.
A U.S. unilateral attack would likely provoke nuclear North Korea to retaliate against the South, putting at immediate risk the millions of people who live in Seoul and other areas close to the inter-Korean border. Analysts say any U.S. unilateral action against North Korea that could also severely strain the alliance between Seoul and Washington. While official reaction in Seoul has been supportive of the U.S. Naval Strike Force deployment, some candidates running for president in South Korea are urging caution. It is also unknown how China would react. Meng says last week's Florida summit between Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping produced no immediate breakthrough on how to deal with the increasing North Korean threat.
The summit meeting is that both sides agreed that the levels of North Korea's WMD threat reached a very serious level. But I think they are still miles apart in terms of what kind of measures have to be taken to deal with the problem.
Although Beijing opposes North Korea's nuclear program, it is reluctant to increase sanctions against its economically dependent ally for fear of causing widespread instability and losing a strategic buffer zone against the United States-South Korea alliance. VOA's Seoul correspondent Braden Patton provided details and audio for this story.
These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. U.S. strike force heading towards North Korea, causing anxiety among friends and foes. Cambodia raises diplomatic alarm with Seabee decision. In Tillerson's first G7 talks, a focus on familiar unresolved conflicts. A report says Chinese and Indian navies thwart Somali pirates. Pakistan sentences a suspected Indian spy to death. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website.
U.S. missile attacks against Syria sent a stern warning to North Korea and China that the United States is ready to use military force if necessary. Prior to the meeting at his Mar-a-Lago estate, President Trump was reportedly presented with a range of options to respond to the North's nuclear weapons program. VOA Korean service reporter Jenny Lee spoke with Tony Blinken, former Deputy Secretary of State. Lee asked Blinken how he would see a resolution to the continued tension on the Korean Peninsula.
I think, in fact, the only way to resolve the issue effectively is through negotiations. But the challenge is convincing Kim Jong-un to negotiate. And there, I think, the only chance of success is doing two things. One, exerting so much pressure on the Kim Jong-un regime that he changes his calculus and sees that his best path to survival is actually through negotiations, not through holding on to nuclear weapons or to further developing them. But second, also making clear that in the event North Korea engages in meaningful denuclearization, that at the end of that process, something like a peace treaty is certainly possible. Mm-hmm. And those are the two sides of the coin that I think we have to deploy.
When should the U.S. administration pursue negotiations? At this point in time, the North Korea is insisting on not giving up its nuclear weapons. But when should the U.S. start to have dialogue with North Korea?
Only when North Korea makes it clear that it's prepared to engage in meaningful, authentic, credible discussions about denuclearization. As long as North Korea refuses to even talk about it, there's really nothing to talk about. If and when North Korea is prepared to talk about it in a meaningful way, then we should. And I think a first step could be getting North Korea to freeze all of its activities, no more nuclear testing, no more missile testing, get inspectors in to verify things. That wouldn't eliminate their existing program, which remains a real threat, particularly to South Korea and Japan. But it would at least stop them from continuing to perfect the program, because testing is vitally important to figuring out how to make their missiles better, their nuclear weapons effective, and to develop an ICBM that could hit the United States.
Blinken added that convincing the North Korean leader to negotiate remains a challenge. He suggests the United States could try exerting so much pressure on Kim Jong-un that he changes his calculus and sees that his best path to survival is actually through negotiations, making it clear that if North Korea engages in denuclearization, a peace treaty would be possible. Our thanks to VOA Korean correspondent Jenny Lee for bringing us the story.
Happening now in Asia, China and South Korea agreed Monday to place tougher sanctions on North Korea if it carries out nuclear or long-range missile tests, according to a senior official in Seoul. The announcement comes as a U.S. Navy strike group heads to the region in a show of force. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
China has called last week's U.S.-China summit in Florida between Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping a great success. The Global Times editorial Monday said the two powers, after a period of uncertainty, are clearly now on the constructive path toward developing a cooperative bilateral relationship. It said neither China nor the United States can afford the hefty price of abandoning means of cooperation. The 2 days of talks at the Mar-a-Lago resort, while overshadowed by a U.S. missile strike against a Syrian airbase, focused on the two countries' trade imbalance and the North Korean nuclear threat. Appearing Sunday on U.S. television, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the two leaders had extensive discussions on the serious situation in North Korea.
They met for quite some time one-on-one to discuss North Korea. And there was a full range of options that were discussed between the two leaders. President Xi expressed agreement that the situation has reached a new level of seriousness and threat. He expressed a view that he wanted to be supportive in terms of causing the regime in Pyongyang to change its view around the future need for those weapons. China has expressed on multiple occasions, and they reaffirmed it in our discussions with us here in Mar-a-Lago, that their policy is unchanged, and that is for a denuclearized Korean peninsula.
Tillerson described the talks as very frank and candid. He said the two leaders agreed to work in concert to expand areas of cooperation while managing differences based on mutual respect. University of Chicago China specialist Dolly Young tells VOA's Victor Beatty this was Mr. Trump's most significant meeting with a world leader since he took office in January, in large part because of the impact of relations between the world's two top economies.
The two governments actually agreed to develop a set of comprehensive dialogues covering four different areas, essentially putting U.S.-China relations more comprehensive platform going forward. And I think that signals, actually, despite all the rhetoric during the campaign and also in the early days of the Trump administration, the two sides are really getting down to the work to really put this relationship on more institutionalized footing. And of course, at the same time, the atmosphere for the meeting was very important. Emphasis on friendship, on getting things done, and so on. The Trump administration, of course, emphasized that they want to have a results-oriented relationship. In fact, the documents coming out of the summit meeting tells us that they want to actually find out what can be done on a variety of issues within 100 days, in particular in the area of trade and investment. And I think the two sides would be working very hard to try to resolve certain issues going forward. So I think actually overall, this was quite a positive meeting, and it really brings us back from the kind of harsh rhetoric that we saw in the early days of the Trump administration regarding the relations between the two world's largest economies.
Do you see the chemistry between the two men improving bilateral ties?
Oh, definitely. I think actually, and of course, we see some official photos. Some of the unofficial photos show that they were pretty actually relaxed with each other. They were really talking, getting along. They spent 7 hours all together. And of course, involving not only the dinner, but also actually some sort of parallel discussions, meetings across different areas by the members of these very substantial delegation from China and, of course, cabinet members from the U.S. and other senior advisors to the president.
Dalyoung said he expects some form of trade understanding between the two countries, similar to the export restraints agreed to by Japan in the 1980s. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Scientists warn that after two consecutive years of coral bleaching, Australia's Great Barrier Reef has zero prospect of recovery. Scientists say coral reefs take a decade to recover, but after back-to-back bleachings, only a third of the reef has left unscathed. Follow these and other stories on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Cambodia's decision to walk out on a contract with the U.S. Navy Mobile Construction Battalion, or the Seabees, the move has sent off alarm bells within the diplomatic community and raised concerns that Prime Minister Hun Sen is prepared to sacrifice millions of dollars worth of humanitarian work to appease regional powers like Russia and China.
But I would find it extraordinary that Cambodians would happily cancel these type of projects without something coming in to replace it.
That's Billy Chai Lung Tai, an independent human rights consultant at CL Consulting.
But who is going to be building these projects, and where is that money going to come from? Or are these schools and hospitals that simply just not going to be built? And if that is the case, are these projects are now going to be picked up by Chinese-funded projects?
The Cambodian government has not said why it declined to renew its CB contract, a move described by one diplomat as another poke in the eye for the Americans. It's a point of frustration for Washington, given the nature of the CB work, says Jay Ryman, spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Phnom Penh.
Since 2008, the CBs have carried out $5 million worth of construction projects that benefited tens of thousands of Cambodians across the country. They completed construction projects such as maternity wards, hospital improvements, water wells, bathroom facilities, and public schools, and similar projects, working hand-in-hand with the Royal Cambodian Armed Forces and local communities. They were scheduled to build 6 additional bathroom facilities at schools and 2 new maternity wards this year and next. And they had many other projects planned for 2018 and 2019. Unfortunately, those have now been canceled.
Whether China or Russia will step in to fill the breach remains to be seen, but the apparent use of genuine humanitarian works for political point scoring has left Cambodia's most vulnerable even further exposed. And Steve, the cancellation of the agreement means at least 20 planned projects will be scrapped in a move reminiscent of Cold War plays.
Right. Carl Thayer, emeritus professor at the Australian Defense Force Academy at Hun Sen, might be attempting to reposition Cambodia politically on his belief that the United States is on the decline in East Asia while Russia is seeking to raise its regional profile. This was helped by a shift towards China by Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte and a lack of clear foreign policy direction from the White House following the recent election of President Donald Trump. In January, Phnom Penh suspended joint military exercises with the U.S., citing the June elections as cause, while rejecting suggestions that its decision was related to military and financial ties with China. With commune elections due in June and general elections in July of next year, the ruling party is increasingly relying on Chinese generosity as its backbone for a booming post-war economy. And two-way trade between Cambodia and China is expected to top $5 billion this year.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte clarified his statement on sending troops to the South China Sea. He assured Beijing no offensive weapons would be placed on Manila's assets. Duterte said the Philippines wanted peace and friendship with China. VOA keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, being an Asian American performer in the United States can have its advantages and sometimes challenges. Enoch Chan is from Hong Kong, and he moved to the United States as a young child. He's now an entrepreneur who runs his own production company. He shoots photos, videos, edits, and does lighting direction for TV and news. Chan recently sat down with VOA Asia social media producer Ali Ogden on a Facebook Live show to show us his studio and why he chose to be behind the camera instead of in front of it.
So for our viewers who are in Asia, you know, what can you tell them about your experience in American life and, you know, being an entrepreneur and starting your own business?
I mean, there's a lot of things that are easier and a lot of things that are harder. I mean, it's definitely harder as it's changing culture. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things I was heading towards. You know, I actually really like being on stage and acting and, you know, being in film and video and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it's an avenue that wasn't and isn't as open to me as an Asian American here.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, it's very rare that you see Asian Americans on TV. A little bit more now, but mm-hmm. usually, you know, it's a little bit harder to break in.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
That's actually why I went more like directing side and tech side and mm-hmm. and more sort of behind the scenes, because mm-hmm. it's easier sometimes to do that than it is for it to, even as hard as it is, than it is to, you know, be in front of the camera.
In front of the camera.
Yeah.
So you decided to go with the route being more behind the camera, doing lighting,
film,
video, instead of being in front of the camera.
And also then I can make the choice to try to get more people of more ethnicities like in front of the camera.
Right.
As a director, I have that choice. Like, well, you know what? I don't have to cast a white person. You know, I can cast someone who's, you know, black or Asian American. Or Hispanic, and have them in whatever role I want them to be in, and not have it be dictated by.
I mean, I did notice that even in the Golden Globes that we had recently? There weren't,
there were not very many
Asian Americans.
There were very few.
That were in front of the camera.
Yeah, it's a little sad that way.
It's a little sad,
because I feel like, you know, we're pretty large part of the culture at this point.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a lot of, you know, cultural things that are Asian that have been taken into American culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, so much, you know, Eastern philosophy and so much, you know, yoga and so much, you know, different like Eastern ideas that have been taken into American culture.
Absolutely.
But yet it's so hard to see us as Asian Americans on TV,
mm-hmm.
Or on screen.
So that was one of the more challenging things that you just mentioned. What about kind of one of the positive things about life in the United States?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of positive things. I think my parents came from Hong Kong. My dad actually had lived through some of the Cultural Revolution when
mm-hmm.
he was younger, and he and my grandparents, you know, escaped to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the takeover in 1997, they were very scared of what would happen. and what it would mean to live in a communist China.
Right.
And so because of that, they came here. My dad was...
So that was what drove them to come to the United States.
Oh, yeah, that was a huge thing. Yeah, because they had both had really good government jobs teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But they came here to sort of, like, make sure that my sister and I would have the freedoms that they enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Definitely, like, went through a lot in that whole process.
Right.
They came in the early 80s, which wasn't the best time to come. And, you know, even though they had all these degrees, they couldn't get, like, full-time work for a while because they didn't have any American experience
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that on the whole other side of things, you know, this is a society that's based on the idea of being classless, of you being able to move and have mobility within classes.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, if you work hard enough and you push hard enough, you can get to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always ceilings. You know, there's always like
sure.
points where you just can't get in the same room with the people you need to be in to get to the next place.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, if you work hard enough, there is a lot you can do.
It's a fun interview, and you can catch Ali's entire interview with Enoch Chan. Check out his studio by watching the video on our VOA Asia Facebook page.
Researchers in a pilot clinical trial have made it possible for a paralyzed man to move his arm. As Brunwyn Benito reports, it is a critical step towards restoring mobility to people with paralysis.
Bill Koshevar was in a bike accident 8 years ago that left him with a severe spinal cord injury. He's paralyzed from the shoulders down, but today he's feeding himself mashed potatoes and drinking coffee. He's part of a study at Case Western Reserve University, where researchers have combined two investigational technologies to obtain remarkable results. Robert Kirsch is chair of the university's Department of Biomedical Engineering.
For the first time, we've implanted brain recording electrodes in a person and an FES system.
FES stands for Functional Electrical Stimulation. In this case, 36 electrodes implanted in Koshevar's right upper and lower arm electrically stimulate the muscles in his hand, elbow, and shoulder. But that is only part of what he needs for the movement.
When somebody has a spinal cord injury, a perfectly working brain is essentially disconnected from an otherwise perfectly working body.
Research study co-author Lee Hochberg says the brain-computer interface, BrainGate, reconnects the part of Koshevar's brain that controls movement to muscles in his arm and hand. Surgically implanted electrodes on the surface of the motor cortex of his brain transmit neural signals that researchers can record.
We were able to decode that brain activity, send those commands down to the FES system, and he was able to reach out and pick up that cup again with his own arm and hand.
Koshevar describes his ability to move just that little bit as awesome.
You know, yes, I'm injured, but it's not like my life stopped when I got injured.
We've bridged his spinal cord injury. He can now think about moving his arm, and his arm moves.
My father said, "Do you really want to do this?" I said, "Yes." Somebody has to do research. If nobody does research, things don't get done.
Koshevar's contribution to that research through feedback and suggestions is enabling doctors and engineers, like Hochberg and Kirsch, to build technology that will help other people with paralysis in the future.
Now we can tell the world it's possible to reconnect the brain and make the arm move again.
Other investigational BrainGate research has shown that people with paralysis can control a cursor on a computer screen or a robotic arm. Bronwyn Benito, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
Amazing technology. You've been listening to VOA Asia. As we always tell you, you can check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. That's where you'll also find Steve Miller with Asia in a Minute.
Yes, you can find it every Monday through Friday. And on the weekends, we have Asia Weekly, which is a recap of five of the biggest stories during the week.
Worth your time. Check it out on VOA Asia Facebook. Also, we're a podcast. You can download it and take our program anywhere you go. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Daryl Smith, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, which, of course, includes my colleague, Steve Miller, and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.